2 and 3. KPFT, Houston.
Calling all Cajuns and un-Cajuns, those who want to be Cajuns or those who think they're Cajuns.
KPFT is having their 11th annual Cajun Gumbo Cook-Off April 9th at Billy's Hall in Pearland.
Entertainment will be held by Gino Delafosse and the Cajun and Zydeco bands, and also Don Fontenot, the Donkey Man,
the Zydeco Dots, and Dallas Street Ramblers. Come join us for KPFT's 11th annual Cajun Gumbo Cook-Off.
April the 9th at Billy's Hall in Pearland.
Gumbo Cookers Wanted for KPFT's Cajun Gumbo Cook-Off on April 9th.
You can give us a call at 713-526-4000 or kpft.org.
Listen to PT's Cajun Bandstand on Saturday morning for more information. This will be a benefit for KPFT.
Houston.
Houston's animal shelters kill approximately 80,000 dogs and cats every year. That's over 220 pets every single day. However, other communities have discovered how to stop the killing entirely. They have become no-kill communities and have proven that there are enough homes to adopt all the pets entering shelters each year. The key is a compassionate shelter director who is dedicated to saving lives. Join us in our mission to make Houston a no-kill city. Go to our website at nokillhouston.org to learn the 10 simple things that you can do to help us save the lives of Houston's pets.
I'm just a-walking my dog, singing my song, strolling along. It's just me and my dog, catching some sun. We can't go wrong. My life is lonely and blue. Yeah, I was sad as a sailor. I was an angry one too. Then there was you appeared when I was entangled with youth and fear. And nerves jangled, jangled, vermouth and beer were getting me mangled up. But then I looked in your eyes and I was no more a failure. You looked so wacky and wise. And I said, Lord, I'm happy cause I'm just a-walking my dog, singing my song, strolling along. Oh, it's just me and my dog, catching some sun. We can't go wrong. And I don't care about your hate and your doubt. And I don't care what the politicians thought. If you need a companion, why just go out by the pound and buy yourself a hound and make that dog get proud. Cause that's what it's all about.
We're listening to vegan artist Nellie McKay with the Dog Song. Tonight on Vegan World Radio, Bette Suttermeyer from No Kill Houston will be guest hosting and interviewing Nathan Winograd in advance of the April 30 No Kill Seminar in Houston. Also, we'll hear about the Texas Companion Animal Protection Act to be decided by the state legislature. Texas State Legislature. All this and more coming up next on Vegan World Radio here on KPFT 90.1 FM Houston and 89.5 Galveston and 89.7 Huntsville.
And I said, Lord, I'm happy because I'm just walking my dog, singing my song, strolling along. It's just me and my dog, catching some sun. We can't go wrong. And I don't care about your hate and your doubt. And I don't care what the politicians spout. If you need a companion, why just go out by the pound and find yourself a hound and make that dog get proud.
Hello, I'm Bette Suttermeyer, president of No Kill Houston. We're a non-profit organization dedicated to bringing the successful no-kill model of sheltering to Houston's animal shelters. Our goal is to stop the needless deaths of the 80,000 animals that are killed in Houston's five kill shelters each year. There are open admission shelters all over the U.S. and in other countries that have stopped shelter killing, and we want this for Houston. And our special guest today is Nathan Winograd. Now, Nathan has an impressive resume. He is the director of the National No-Kill Advocacy Center. He is a graduate of Stanford Law School, a former criminal prosecutor and attorney. He has held a wide variety of leadership positions, including Director of Operations for the San Francisco SPCA and Executive Director of the Tompkin County, New York SPCA, two of the most successful no-kill shelters in the nation. Nathan has spoken nationally and internationally on animal sheltering issues. He has written animal protection legislation at the state and national level. He's created successful no-kill programs in both urban and rural communities. And he has consulted with a wide range of animal protection groups, including some of the largest and best known in the nation. And Nathan is also the author of two groundbreaking and award-winning books. One is Redemption, The Myth of Pet Overpopulation and the No-Kill Revolution in America. And the second is Irreconcilable Differences, The Battle for the Heart and Soul of America's Animal Shelters. And also in August of 2009, Nathan was hired by the City of Houston to assess Houston's animal control facility. His extensive report is posted on No Kill Houston's website at nokillhouston.org, and I urge everyone in Houston to check that out. Now, we're going to talk to Nathan about the all-day Building a No-Kill Community seminar in Houston on April 30th. And also about HB 3450, which is the Companion Animal Protection Act, which was recently filed in Texas. Hi, Nathan. Thanks for being with us again today.
It's my pleasure, Beth. I'm happy to be on.
Now, first of all, there are a lot of people who still have some misconceptions about what no-kill sheltering means. In fact, yesterday I saw a comment that a woman thought it means animals will spend years in cages and never get adopted. So can you explain your definition of the no-kill model of sheltering, just so we're all on the same page?
Sure. I mean, it's not surprising that that is the viewpoint. In fact, you know, for many years, our shelters have been little more than places where most animals went to be killed. And when the no-kill movement first came on the scene in the mid-1990s, when the city and county of San Francisco decided it was going to stop the killing of at least initially healthy dogs and cats, and then move to save sick and injured but treatable dogs and cats, it was very threatening to shelter directors around the country that were still running shelters that killed the bulk of their occupants. And so one of the things they tried to do, Bet, is to paint the no-kill alternative to what they were doing, to impounding and killing most animals, as something that was darker. And one of the ways they tried to disparage the no-kill philosophy was to suggest and to say that if we didn't kill these animals, they would literally be piling up in overcrowded facilities. The animals would not be adopted because there were too many for the too few homes available, and they would essentially go crazy sitting in cages. So they essentially painted this movement to save lives as akin to hoarding. Well, that's not what the no-kill philosophy is about, and that's not how either no-kill shelters or no-kill communities that pay credence to the philosophy run. In fact, when I ran the Tompkins County SPCA in upstate New York, which was the animal control shelter for the entire county, you know, we took in all animals. We took in all owner surrendered animals. We took in all stray animals. And our average length of stay was only 8 days. So you can run an open admission, no-kill shelter, save all healthy and treatable animals, including feral cats, and you can do it without having the animals sitting in cages. I mean, I think the biggest misconception, which underlies the viewpoint that no-kill equals hoarding, is that the biggest mythology that underlies that is this belief that there aren't enough homes for the animals that are entering shelters, and we simply know that's not true. We know that's not true, not only because of my experience in Tompkins County and now the experience of other open admission no-kill shelters, but all the data points to the fact that if anything, is true. It's that there are a lot more Americans looking to bring in a new animal into their homes than the total number of animals entering shelters.
Wow, that's incredible. And this one to point out, too, that we're talking about healthy and treatable animals, because I think a lot of people listening may not realize that many times shelters kill animals saying that they are ill, when actually it's just an illness that is not life-threatening and could actually be treatable. So that's a little misconception that a lot of the shelters like to put out there, especially in their advertising, especially in Houston.
You're absolutely right, Beth. I mean, look, what we know from the best performing shelters around the country, and what we know looking at, for example, dog bite extrapolation data, is that roughly somewhere in the neighborhood of about 95% of all animals entering shelters are what we call savable, meaning they are either healthy or they are sick, injured, or traumatized, but they can be rehabilitated. So in other words, looking at it from the vantage point of that other 5%, they're not hopelessly ill, they're not irremediably suffering, and they're not vicious dogs who have a poor prognosis for rehabilitation. And so for 95% of the animals, we can save them. And in fact, there are a number of communities around the country that are saving them. And like I said, I ran Tompkins County, which was the first no-kill community, and that facility has been no-kill for almost a decade now. So
wow.
Not only can we save them, but we know it's sustainable. And Bet, when you look at the numbers, it's not even close. So, you know, we have been told for so many years that the reason shelters are killing animals is because there are simply too many of them and too few homes. Now, we know that's not true because we have a number of no-kill communities around the country that are proving that
right.
You can save these animals. So to argue that it's impossible when these communities exist is nonsensical.
Right.
But even when you just look at the data, for example, you know, there are about 4 million animals that are killed in shelters each year. If you actually look at the data for 2010, and there's still some number crunching that needs to be done, it looks like that has come down a little bit. It's going to be somewhere in the neighborhood of between 3.5 and 3.8 million animals. But every year in the United States, there are about 23 million Americans that are going to bring a new animal into their home. Now, we know some of them are going to adopt from the shelter, and those are the animals that are already being adopted. We know that some of them are going to get their animal from another source, like a breeder or a pet store, or perhaps a rescue group. But for 17 million of those Americans, they've not decided where they're going to get their animal from, and surveys have shown that they have a good view of shelters. So all we have to do is convince a small percentage of that 17 million to adopt the 3 million or so animals who are being killed in shelters but for a home, and we would zero out the killing. So not only do we have enough homes for these shelter animals, the numbers aren't even close.
That is fantastic. It's just fantastic news. Now, you are going to be in Houston on April 30th giving a seminar called Building a No-Kill Community. And a lot of Houstonians are really excited that you've agreed to give it here, especially since this is the only time in 2011 that you will present it. So tell us about some of the things that you plan to teach at this seminar.
Well, I'm pretty excited about it myself. It's an all-day seminar, so we are going to go all day, and we're going to give the attendees who come to it, essentially, we're going to give them a PhD in saving lives. The seminar will cover the history of the no-kill movement. It will show what communities have been successful, and what's really exciting is what people are going to learn, for example, is they're going to look at these communities and they're going to see before and after. Because one of the arguments that you hear shelter directors who are still operating kill shelters make is that there's got to be something unique about these communities that have stopped the killing of savable multiple animals that have allowed them to do so. In other words, they want to isolate those communities to show why they believe it can't happen in their own community. And what people are going to see is that the communities that are saving in excess of 90% of the animals at one time were as regressive and as draconian as the communities that continue killing. I mean, one of the examples is very close to Houston. It's the community of Austin, Texas. You know, at one point, the shelter director who ran the city facility there killed an animal every 12 minutes the shelter was open to the public. Over 100,000 animals during her tenure. And she killed them because she refused to do simple common sense programs that provided alternatives to killing, and now the shelter is saving 90% of all animals by putting in place those simple common sense programs. And that is another thing that we will cover in the seminar. We're going to go through all the programs and services that make no kill possible. So while we encourage animal lovers and advocates to demand that the killing stop in their shelters, we also want to empower them with the tools of how, in fact, a shelter goes from killing animals to saving 90, 92, 93, 94, 95%, and in some cases, even higher. We'll go through some of those programs in detail. What is it that shelters should be doing to keep dogs and cats from coming into the shelter in the first place? How do we keep them with their responsible caretakers? In other words, how do we overcome the behavior or medical or environmental conditions which cause people to relinquish their animals? If they do come into the shelter, how do we keep them moving through the system so that they get healthy? If they come in sick or injured, they stay healthy. If they come in healthy and move as quickly as possible into loving new homes. I will also provide a workshop on reforming animal control. Unfortunately, while my hope is that we will have a fair number of shelter staff and shelter directors present, we know from painful experience that not all communities are dedicated to saving lives. And what I want to do, Bette, is empower the animal advocates in attendance to wage a campaign to either reform the shelter and force the director to embrace the no-kill model of sheltering, and if they refuse to do so, how to get that shelter director replaced with someone who is more compassionate and willing to do what the animal lovers of their community have entrusted them to do. And finally, we'll have a workshop on leadership. I think one of the misconceptions that we see a lot in this movement is that somehow you, for example, Bette, or someone in attendance needs to find a savior, that they're not cut out to run shelters. And I think that is the biggest misconception. I think, you know, when I think about who the no-kill leaders of tomorrow are, we don't know who they are, because it really doesn't require years of sheltering experience. What it requires is a can-do attitude, a commitment and passion for saving lives, and a skill set from other areas that can be applied to animal sheltering. You know, when I went into animal sheltering, I was a former criminal prosecutor and corporate attorney. If you look at the heads of the most successful and progressive shelters in the country, without exception, they've come from other careers, and they applied the skill set they learned in those other areas to sheltering. For example, Bonnie Brown, who runs the Nevada Humane Society, was a high-end retail buyer for corporations in Boston. Like I said, I was an attorney. The head of the San Francisco shelter during the 1990s was a lobbyist for the pharmaceutical industry and former attorney. So if you just look at the successful shelter directors around the country, they didn't come in with 20 years of sheltering experience, and so I want to empower and encourage the people in attendance to apply whatever skills they have from whatever careers they have now, and see if they can take over these shelters, because that is the quickest way that we can reclaim these institutions and orient them back towards life-saving.
Right, and I hope a lot of people get excited. I really think that that you'll get them excited about applying to these jobs. And one of the things that you're going to talk about is high volume adoptions, which I'm really excited about for even the shelters who are doing fairly well, who I talk to a lot, because something I found out last year that really blew me away is the Nevada Humane Society. You know, are one of the masters of high volume adoptions, and last year, during 1 month, they adopted out 1,000 animals. And then I looked at the same time period in Houston for Houston's Animal Control, or BARC, and they had adopted out about 300 animals. And in just a current perspective, Houston is five times the size of Reno, Nevada, but we adopted out one-third of the animals. So I think this should clearly show the leadership in Houston that BARC is not doing everything that it could to adopt out all the animals that we could here in Houston. And we should really be asking ourselves, why isn't BARC trying to copy Nevada Humane Society's adoption successes? I mean, clearly we can do better. So I really hope that leadership in Houston and the directors of all the kill shelters here come, if not just for that one part, because I really think that could drop the kill rate immensely if they would just put the same program into place.
Well, you know, you're absolutely right. If you were to ask me what is the single most important program that any shelter should be focusing the lion's share of their resources and efforts on, it's adoptions. I mean, that's not to say the other programs aren't important. I mean, for example, a feral cat isn't going to be adopted and doesn't necessarily need an adoption program. What they need is either to be left alone, or if they do make their way to the shelter, to be sterilized and released back to their habitat. So these other programs obviously are important, but more than any other program, adoptions are going to give you the most bang for your buck in terms of life saving. Well, for one, it's the most cost effective program because it brings in revenue as opposed to just being a cost center. So you know the more animals you adopt, the more revenue you bring in for other life saving efforts. But more than that, you know, for so many years that we've been told that you can't adopt your way out of killing, and you know, that's false on so many levels. I think the comparison between your shelter and the shelter in Washoe County or Reno, Nevada is a good one, because there is a shelter, for example, that for 20 years argued that there were too many animals and not enough homes, that they were doing the best job they could, that there simply weren't the homes available, and they were maximizing their efforts. As soon as the new director came in started focusing on high-volume adoptions, they essentially went from adopting out 4,000 animals a year to adopting out almost 10,000.
Wow.
You know, more than doubled the number of animals adopted. Now, that doesn't include all the other great things they're doing, which we'll talk about as well, such as, like I mentioned earlier, helping people retain their animals. You know, in fact, in one of the surveys we did at the Nevada Humane Society, we took the number of people who called and wanted to surrender their animals who were funneled to their pet retention program, a program to help people resolve the issues they're having that might cause them to relinquish their animals, and the number of people who actually ended up relinquish their animals declined by 59%.
Wow.
So there's a lot of different things we can do to save lives, but adoptions really is the key. And when I look around the country, and if again, I haven't been back to Houston since I did my evaluation at BARC, but what I saw back then and what I documented in the nearly 200-page report was very poor efforts at finding animals' homes. And You know, when you compare it to the incredible success of Tompkins County and the success in other communities like Marquette, Michigan, which went from a 64% killing rate to a 93% save rate overnight by focusing on adoptions. When you look at my success in Tompkins County, the success of San Francisco, the success of other communities now that are saving better than 90% of the animals, the real hard emphasis was on a really comprehensive adoption program that reached out to the people, that marketed the animals, that took the animals where people lived, worked, and played, that incentivized adoptions, that made the adoption process fun, that made the shelter welcoming. All those things tie into high volume adoptions. And if Washoe County can better than double adoptions, going from 4,000 to 10,000 with one-fifth the population of Houston, really the sky is the limit for the Houston community. And keep in mind, Beth, that when you talk to the folks in Washoe County, for example, if you were to talk to the director who runs Washoe County Regional Animal Services, their municipal facility, he will tell you, and as he told me, that he was a skeptic, that he didn't believe that no-kill was possible in his community because he felt the population was too transient, that it was not a wealthy community. He felt the pet population was too thick, meaning they had a very, very high intake rate. And in fact, Washoe County has a higher per capita intake rate than Houston, Texas does. He describes how they had two staff members whose full-time job was to kill animals from the moment they walked into the shelter in the morning till the moment they clocked out to go home. In fact, the barrels used to fill up every day with their bodies, and every day someone would come and empty the barrels, and every day they'd fill them up again. And when I met with him, he was incredibly skeptical, but what he was willing to do was to try, because he knew what they were doing was not working. And he didn't want to, even though he never felt that they could cross the goal line, given all those perceived obstacles, again, he was willing to try. And, this is a facility that last year saved 91% of all the animals.
Wow.
And he will tell you that even though he didn't think they could cross the goal line, he was willing to put these principles and programs into practice as comprehensively as possible, because even if they never crossed the goal line, he knew he could save more lives than he was saving at the time. So
right.
He was willing to save more animals than he was, and he realized that would make a lot of animals happy, but it would also make a lot of people who love them happy, and he saw that as his obligation as the head of an agency that was supposed to reflect the people and fulfill their desires. Within a year they were at better than 90% save rate, and now he goes around the country talking to other animal control officers and shelters, saying, look, I was where you are. I was skeptical, but I couldn't argue with the data. I couldn't argue with the fact that this success was spreading across the country and there were other communities doing it. I, too, at one point thought my community was unique, and I am glad to be proved wrong.
Wow, that's incredible. And I wish the kill shelters here in Houston would listen to him a little bit more. It can make such a big difference. And if listeners would like to find out how they can attend Nathan's No Kill Seminar, you can find all that information on our website at nokillhouston.org. So we know that there are a lot of communities that have reached no kill, even open admission shelters, meaning they don't say no to intakes. And two of Houston's neighbors have reached no kill, and one you mentioned earlier in the last couple of months. Austin's facility, I believe, saved 92% of all animals in February. Williamson County Animal Control has been saving 90% or more for several months and even reached 96% save rate. And this is just fabulous success. And the reason these shelters are becoming so successful is, again, because they're following the no-kill model that you've created, that you've written two books about, that you teach in your seminars. So with all the successful open admission, no-kill shelters popping up in at least four countries, why do you suppose that there's still around 3,000 shelters, including five in Houston, that absolutely refuse to follow this model? This just doesn't make any sense to me.
Well, I think one of the things that we have to, one of the mythologies that we have to shed is that that we all want the same things, that we are all on the same team, and that anyone who runs a shelter or works at a shelter or runs or works at a humane society or an SPCA is passionate about saving lives, is someone who would leave no stone unturned if it meant they could save rather than kill an animal. Unfortunately, you know, there was a time when humane societies and SPCAs first popped into the American landscape in the 19th century. And if you were to go back and, you know, granted all these humane societies are independent organizations, they all have very similar histories. I mean, they're distinct organizations. They have their own rules and their own bylaws, but they have very similar histories. And they were founded by people who were incredibly compassionate and very dedicated to saving lives. And over the years, these organizations have gotten very large, and they have gotten very influential, but they've also become very bureaucratic, and they have none of the zeal that characterized the movement's early founders. And what has happened over time is that working at a humane society or an SPCA or even a municipal shelter has become a job as opposed to a mission, no different than a job working in other areas or other fields that have nothing to do with animal protection. And so unfortunately for the animals, some people that work at these facilities are just there to collect a paycheck, and whether the animal lives or dies doesn't matter to them. In fact, historically, until fairly recently, if people wanted to work at the public shelter, the animal control shelter in Houston, you know, it would be like applying for any job in government. You had to take a city aptitude test, and the people that scored the lowest on that city aptitude test were given the power of life and death at the animal shelter. I mean, that just shows you how little, what little regard historically the city had for what happened to those animals. It is a, you know, they located the shelter away from retail businesses. There's no foot traffic in the facility. It's hard to get to. I'm hoping they changed it, but when I went there, the hours were wrong on their sign. The phone number had been disconnected. I mean, there was such a callous disregard for what happened to those animals. And it wasn't until the no-kill movement and, you know, a public clamor for change did, you know, we force attention on what was happening to these animals at public shelters and private shelters and humane societies around the country. And one of the reasons for that, Bed, is because they had two convenient excuses for the staggering levels of killing that they were doing behind closed doors. One, they blamed pet overpopulation. So they argued there were too many animals, not enough homes, which we now know is not true, is a fabrication. And secondly, they blamed the irresponsible public, saying that the public was to blame for the killing. And I don't deny that there are some people in the community that are irresponsible, and I don't deny that some people should not have animals and should not be allowed to have animals because they are grossly irresponsible. But that's not how most people are. I mean, that is a small subsection of the population. Most people, most Americans, I should say, care very deeply about companion animals. In fact, just this last week, we saw new data that showed that spending on our animals is now the eighth largest economic sector of our economy. And that's a number that increases every single year, even during periods of economic downturn. So we just crossed the $50 billion mark in terms of how much people spend on their companion animals, even as most other areas or sectors of our economy have been essentially been in a free fall. Not only do we spend that much on our animals, but we give hundreds of millions more to animal-related charities in need. In fact, giving to animal-related causes is the fastest-growing segment in American philanthropy. And when you look around, all you have to do is open your eyes and look around your community to see how deeply we care about animals. You know, the people that we see on our morning dog walks, the people we see playing with their dogs at the park, you know, the veterinary office, you know, the waiting rooms that are always full with people, the books, the bestsellers that are written about animals that are written in ever-increasing numbers, all the movies we see about animals that are a reflection of the love we have for them. But because these shelters simply blamed the irresponsible public and said there were not enough homes, they've essentially been given a blank check to kill as many animals as they want and to neglect and abuse them in many cases in the process. Well, we know that's not true because we now have good, solid data that proves it's not true. We know it's not true because we now have communities across the country that have proven it's not true. And perhaps the most remarkable thing about those communities that have made the successful transition to no-kill is that it didn't take them 10 years to do it. It didn't take them 5 years to do it. They literally did it virtually overnight when long-standing directors who were mired in the failed philosophies of the past that hid behind excuses were replaced. And they were replaced with people who were truly passionate about saving lives and committed to comprehensively implementing the programs and services that make life-saving possible. And these successful communities defy all categorization. Some of them are in the north and some are in the south. Some of them are urban communities and some of them are rural communities. Some of them are in very conservative parts of the country and some of them are in very liberal parts of the country. And if that proves anything, it proves that people of all walks of life want to build a better world for companion animals. And if the shelter director tapped into that compassion rather than blaming those people for the killing, we would be a no-kill nation today, not just in Houston, but in every other city as well.
That's fantastic. Now, hold on to that thought for a moment. We will be right back after a short break.
Hi, this is Pat Greer. I'm one of the producers of Ecology every Wednesday morning right here on KPFT at 6 a.m. Thanks for listening to Vegan World Radio every Wednesday evening at 10 o'clock. KPFT 90.1, Radio for Peace.
Do I need to end at 10:50? Oh, welcome back. Now, the no-kill movement is a grassroots movement that is not only sweeping the U.S., but also Australia, New Zealand, and Canada as well. So, why do you think it's been so successful at the grassroots level?
Well, for all the reasons we talked about before the break, I mean, it, you know, again, we are a dog and cat loving and, you know, other companion animal loving community. And for so long that most people were, you know, saw the killing of animals in shelters as tragic. But necessary, and what the no-kill movement has done is to show them that it's tragic, but it's not necessary,
right.
And we can do something about it. We can do something about the number of animals entering shelters short of killing, and when communities actually make a commitment to no-kill and they ask for the community for help, the community overwhelmingly responds. And so, you know, going back to the first community in the nation to end the killing of healthy homeless dogs and cats, San Francisco, you know, here was a shelter that was 90 days away from bankruptcy. It had a poor public image, and people didn't want to go there to adopt because they didn't want to go into a shelter and have to look into the faces of the animals they didn't pick because they would be killed, and it was not the kind of place where a animal lover, someone who is very passionate about animals, likes to go. And so, but when it made a commitment to make San Francisco a no-kill city, the number of adopters skyrocketed, the number of volunteers skyrocketed, the number of foster parents skyrocketed, donations skyrocketed. I mean, people opened up their hearts, their homes, and their wallets to rally around the cause, and we see the same thing in every other community. You know, one of the most important memories I have as director in of Tompkins County Animal Control in New York was, you know, every time I had a need, every time I had a challenge, I was a one-hit wonder. I got on the radio, I got on television, I started emailing, and I asked the community for help. And every single time they responded enthusiastically. If we had a dog hit by a car that needed major surgery, I would always raise more than I needed for the dog and be able to use that other money for other animals in need. You know, I remember one time we actually did a seizure against a hoarder. It was a multi-agency response, and animals. This was a person that had somewhere in the neighborhood of 250 dogs in their house.
Wow.
And we took the most difficult cases. So we took 60 animals, 60 dogs that had major medical problems. Some of them were blind. Mm-hmm. Some of them had completely rotten teeth. Some of them had tumors. Some of them had, eye injuries. Some of them had neurological problems. And we, I appealed to the community for help. I had veterinarians that closed their offices for the day to come in and do triage.
Wow.
I had a dentist, a human dentist, actually an orthodontist, who said, I've never done dental work on dogs, but the physiology can't be all that different. I'm at least willing to come down and help in any way I can to support or augment the work of veterinarians there. He closed his practice for the day and came down. We had volunteers bathing the dogs, providing TLC. We had groomers come down to do grooming, and bet within 48 hours every one of those animals had a loving new home. That's the kind of thing that requires leadership. That's the kind of thing that requires reaching out to the community. And when you do that, you achieve success. That is what has allowed the folks in Reno, Nevada to go from 4,000 to 10,000 adoptions a year. That is what has allowed Marquette, Michigan to go from a 64% kill rate to a 93% save rate. It's what created no kill in Shelby County, Kentucky. It's what created no kill in Berkeley, California. It's what created no kill in Ivan City, Utah. It's what's created no kill in Charlottesville, Virginia, and it is what has created no kill in communities in Australia, in New Zealand, in Canada. Unfortunately, there are still too many shelters that would rather blame the community and say that the killing is their fault than reach out to the community and include them in the life-saving endeavor. And, you know, one of the things I always say that I didn't create No Kill in Tompkins County, and my employees didn't create No Kill in Tompkins County. All we did was create the environment that allowed the public to rise to the challenge and save all the lives at risk. And all the public needs is to someone to clear the path,
right,
and show them a better way. And in every single community that has done that, the community has rallied around the shelter and helped create and sustain a no-kill community.
Right. That's fabulous. So let's talk about the Companion Animal Protection Act, or CAPA. I'm really happy that a version of this law was filed in Texas recently by State Representative Jessica Farrar, who's actually from Houston. Now, CAPA is really fantastic that it passed. It would abolish the gas chamber. It would abolish what's called heart sticks as a method of euthanasia, except under certain circumstances. It would ban convenience killing, as in killing when they're empty cages. It would mandate collaboration by requiring shelters to work with rescue organizations to maximize life-saving, and some of them do not in Houston. Mandate transparency, requiring shelters to report how many animals they kill, because I don't know if a lot of people know this, but the non-profit kill shelters are not required by law to produce their intake and outcome records, so we have no idea what they're doing. CAPA would also ban the killing of animals based on arbitrary criteria such as breed, age, or color. It would also prohibit selling of shelter animals to research labs. So it does a lot of really fantastic things. But what makes this one different from all the other animal control or animal sheltering laws that are already on the books?
Well, Bet, you know, if you look at all the no-kill communities that exist around the country, the communities that exist in, you know, across the globe in places like New Zealand too, they all got there using the same model, a series of programs and services that we'll talk about at the April 30th seminar in Houston, but that I like to collectively call the no-kill equation. And those programs, comprehensively implemented, have achieved no-kill wherever they have been comprehensively implemented. And what is unfortunate is that, look, we know how to end the killing. And in communities across the country and across the globe, we have. Unfortunately, too many shelters aren't voluntarily implementing the no-kill equation, and as a result, they're needlessly killing animals. So what this law does is, rather than blame the community, rather than rely on the dogmas and mythologies that shelters have built up over the years to point the finger of blame elsewhere and avoid their own responsibility for the staggering level of killing occurring in our nation's shelters, what this law does is force shelters to implement the model that has achieved no-kill. So it forces shelters to do what no-kill shelters are doing. And in that way, it's simply providing these reasonable, common sense policies and procedures that would end the killing. And you know, once CAPA passes and we see a substantial decline in killing in Texas shelters, you know, it's going to even provide further ammunition to allow us to do the same in other states. One of the things that is so ironic is that if you were to stop the average dog or cat lover or bunny lover or hamster lover on the street and tell them what the Companion Animal Protection Act does, they would be shocked. And they would be outraged that shelters aren't doing these simple common sense things now, but they're not. And given that we've known how to end the killing for 15 years, there are too many shelters that refuse to implement these policies, we want to codify them into law to force them to do so that animals can be saved regardless of whether the shelter director loves animals or doesn't love animals, is passionate about saving lives, or couldn't care less whether animals live or die. So animals are saved regardless of zip code, regardless of who runs the shelter, and regardless of how committed or not they are to saving lives, because it will remove the discretion that has allowed shelter directors to avoid doing what's in the best interest of animals and kill them needlessly. That type of environment will be a thing of the past.
Fantastic. And as we said earlier, Nathan will be in Houston on April 30th giving a seminar on building a no-kill community. If you would like to find out more about Nathan's seminar, you can visit our website at nokillhouston.org. And tonight we are giving two pairs of free passes to the first two people who email me at nokillhouston@yahoo.com. If you want to learn how to become part of the no-kill community or about the Companion Animal Protection Act, you can visit Nathan's website at nokilladvocacycenter.org or No-Kill Houston's website at nokillhouston.org. We're also both on Facebook and Twitter, and we both write no-kill issues on examiner.com. And I urge everyone listening tonight to please become informed about how we citizens can stop the killing in Texas animal shelters. And I urge you to please become involved. We need every single voice speaking with us to make these positive changes. The animals entering Texas shelters cannot afford to wait, and it is particularly critical that you speak up now, because the Companion Animal Protection Act has been filed in Texas, and we do need your support. Go to nokillhouston.org to find out how you can help. If you missed any part of the show tonight or you want to hear it again, you can visit the archives at archive.kpft.org. And I want to thank you again for speaking with us again tonight.
I bet it's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Thanks.
I'm gonna pounce.
Okay, that was a fun little song. I'm going to play a really quick clip for you that's based on Nathan Winograd's book. The clip is from a YouTube video called Strayed, and I encourage everybody to try to look that up on YouTube and watch this. It's a very powerful video about a worker in a shelter who's experiencing a very emotional situation.
This video, which was produced by Roxy Video Productions in conjunction with a shelter in Nevada, tells the heart-wrenching story.
I would have lost myself quite a bit in drinking while I was euthanizing. Sometimes I was the one who drew up the euthanasia list. So I would have to walk up and down every row, check everyone's paperwork, and I would have to look at them and say, I don't think you can get adopted.
Yeah.
I don't think you're going to make it, so I'm going to have to put you on the list. And I think that drawing up the list was probably a little bit harder than euthanasia, because you're God. You are making
right.
that choice of who gets euthanized. And there's an old Johnny Cash song, and he says, in the song, he says, there's a man coming around taking names, and he decides who to free and who to blame. And you all won't be treated the same when the man comes around. But when you had a room full of 192 dogs that were happy and jumping around, you knew that there were some that you had to put on that list because their time was up. You're committing murder. You're killing things. That emotional drain that you feel every time you pull up that blue liquid and put it in a vial and know that you're going to stick it in a cat's heart so that they just die instantaneously. And I don't know about you, but the ones that would get me were, they would be purring.
Mm-hmm.
Or like, you are just the best thing.
And then you kill them.
And then you kill them.
Mm-hmm.
After you euthanize these 60 or 70 animals in one day, they're spread out on the floor in front of the crematory. And I used to walk out and they used to think, oh my God, it's a Holocaust. And they would put the cremator up and you'd see the burned bodies and you'd be throwing more in, and then you'd have to scrape the ashes out when they were dead, and or when they finished burning, you'd scrape the ashes out and then just dump them out in the trash. And the whole process is horrendous.
Again, that was a clip called Strayed on YouTube, and I encourage everybody to go see that. Give you a little space here before we move into some announcements. KPFT is going to have a fundraiser for the Prison Reform Film Festival. And that's coming up. That's, again, continuing Friday, Saturday, and Sunday at the Rice Media Center. I encourage everybody to go out to that. You can find out more at www.theprisonshow.org, or probably link through that through KPFT website. But again, www.theprisonshow.org, that's a fundraiser for KPFT Prison Reform Film Festival at Rice Media. The Corridor Rescue Incorporated, Corridor Rescue, needs help from anybody that's can donate or be a foster parent for animals. They are putting out the word that they need help. They've got dogs in shelters right now, and they're using all their funds for that, and so they're in a little bit of a crisis and need some help. You can go to www.petfinder.com and also add to that Corridor Rescue, or just Google Corridor Rescue and find out more information. On April 9th, Saturday, there's an open house at Last Organic Outpost at Emile Street Community Farm. The Last Organic Outpost will be having an open house to showcase the farm and spring crops. Also, the Gunter family will be offering bedding plants with many varieties of tomato squashes and cucumbers and peppers. Meriwether the Adventurer will be conducting a class on self-contained water and planting systems. So there's a lot of cool stuff going on. It's usually really great for kids also. That's farming market weekend is 10 to 5 p.m. Located at 711 North Emile Street. Visit lastorganicoutpost.com. On April 16th, Saturday, 9 to 3, will be the Go Green Flea Market and Eco Fair. It's free admission. There's live music, local bands, crafts, local growers, local farmers, all kinds of stuff going on. Vegan cake vendor, new cruelty-free products, Mahogany Naturals by Natisha Lee, one of our own volunteers here with the show, will be there. That's the location is 13617-13617 Kaltenbrunn Road, 77086. Let's see, or you can go to office at spiritkey.org for information. Email office at spiritkey.org. The registration is, I want to repeat this, we already talked about it with Nathan Renegrad, April 30th, Saturday. Registration is still open for Building a No-Kill Community. No-Kill Houston presents an all-day educational workshop with Nathan Winograd. So you can go to nokillhouston.org for further information. And we want to thank, again, Bette Sundermeyer for coming in and interviewing Nathan on the show. It was a very good interview. Again, you can always go to veganworldradio.org for this information and link to all these things. And now I'm going to introduce a clip from Nellie McKay.
This is
called Columbia's Bleeding, and it's about said experiments, but I wanted to make it subtle in a way that it gives a pastiche of everyday living in Morningside Heights, in the Upper West Side, and around Columbia, being a student and having to deal with the everyday problems that people have to deal with, but also caring about these animals that are being tortured literally blocks from their homes. I live in the neighborhood. I actually live in a building full of Columbia University students. A lot of Columbia University students and teachers are my friends, and I believe that the experiments which it is supporting and conducting need to be stopped because they are heinous. They are not only an assault against humanity, but they really bring down the university. My mother read Peter Singer's Animal Liberation, and we became involved with the New York Animal Rights Movement. I was 8 years old, and I became a vegetarian. I think if your parents are committed, much easier for a young person to be also. I would hope that they would write and put pressure by any means they can on their administration to close these laboratories and end these tests. They're not helping human beings.
I'd like us to spend just a minute envisioning, if you will with me please, the last mile.
Houston Normal will be having our 10th annual 420 Festival on April 23rd at the Last Concert Cafe. Jody James from the Journey for Justice, Texas Style, will be our featured speaker.